Lee. But he isn't looking at me either. And neither of them denies it. I feel a different rage heat the corners of my eyes. Hours ago, I contemplated leading Kallipolis into the future alongside Lee. Now I'm wondering if he just walked away from a crime scene to help the people tearing the city apart. The words form and rest on my tongue. We said we would do this together. I let them die there. Whatever I imagined First Ridership being, when I wanted it so badly, this is the last thing I pictured. Defending Golds at a dinner party and staring down my friends. It's a shit job. But it's my job. And I will do it. I turn my back on both of them, leaving Ayla to snort ash behind me. What happened? I asked Duck. Pivoting. Back to the mission with New Pythos. The war that matters. The only thing left that I can think of without a nauseating mixture of rage and shame. Duck casts a bemused look between the boys and me. But when none of us explains our frosty silence, he clears his throat. A strange, bitter note enters his voice that I've never heard before. Chrissa covered for me. Then his eyes find mine. Uncertain. One of the muzzled riders got her bad. Behind us, Phaedra lets out a wail, and I finally look at her. Not just her wing is torn, her side is gashed, as if talons pierced and pulled along her flank. It's the first time I've ever heard a dragon cry from pain. Where is she? Lee asks.
There. They're tending her inside.
Lee leaves us at a run. Cor and I don't speak to each other as we follow, tracing echoing steps down the ward to the sounds we can hear from the threshold of the infirmary. Lee is holding Chrissa still while they cut the flame suit off her leg. The gashes that marked Phaedra's side mark hers. Here, unlike with Duck, I breathe in not just dragon fire, but the sharp, unmistakable smell of burned flesh. Chrissa's face has turned into Lee's arm, buried against it as she cries, but even muffled, I feel a chill go down my spine at the sound. Lee's face is downturned, murmuring. A muzzled rider did this. A rider I told her to attempt to contact. The nurse pulls, Chrissa screams, and Lee lowers his crumpling face to her hair. Cor goes to them. I'm sorry, I hear myself say as I back away. I'm not sure who I'm speaking to, because none of them are listening.
13. Aloe and Ginger. Griff. The burns, the cold wet of the winter fog, and the strain of hauling Dilo to his quarters in the Provisional Palace end in a fever that takes 2 days to break. Sick as a drowned dragon, I lie by the fire, vomit in a pail, and sweat through the piles of blankets Aga's thrown over me. Whenever I wake, Aga forces me to drink more broth. All I can think, when I can think anything, is that for every day I miss, Scully will dock my pay. When I try to force my way out of bed, Aga pushes me back down. Don't you worry about that. We'll be fine. You need to rest. Children, she minds, sneak over occasionally to peer at me. And in the fever, they seem like tiny spirits asking shrill and stupid questions. Do you really ride a dragon? Aga shoos them away, and I drift off again. When the world comes into focus at last, Aga is sitting at my side with Becca, working a mortar and pestle, filling the room with the smell of mashed aloe as she tells Becca a story. Granda's out. Judging by the light coming through the slats, it's past midday. And so the nag told the great dragon, "Never again shall you threaten our waters, never so long as Kraken and I oppose, and Turret stands watch." Aga spots me. "Oh, you're awake. And then?" Becca asks, but Aga waves a hand. "You know what next. Here, Griff, have some tea." I take it, expecting hot water, but when I drink, I realize it is tea. Aga's ginger. "We shouldn't waste this. I've plenty. Turn on your good side." The sight of a poultice makes me come to my senses. Behind her on the table sits an aloe plant I've never seen before. And the glass jar that was almost out of ginger sits beside it, full again. "Where'd we get aloe from?" Aga looks surprised. "Lord Dilo, of course," she says. Lord Dilo. The whole thing comes back to me at once, not just the pursuit of those Kallipolans, but what came before it. Dilo, offering to help us. Shaynan, bitten and burned in the training pen. Rode, saying, "I'll consider it when I ask for a waived punishment if I brought down a Kallipolan." And then I didn't. I groan aloud. "Save the aloe," I tell Aga. "Aga, I'm so sorry. I'm going in the pen again." Aga ignores me, pulling up my shirt and touching cool ointment to my side. I can't remember the last time I was given aloe. It's always been a luxury reserved for the Dragonborn riders. "You aren't." She flashes me that same knowing smile she gave the morning Dilo visited. "Dilo got your punishment waived. That poor boy. Has he been pining since before Julia? I had no idea." "What? He's not pining." "Griff," says Aga, tapping my nose. "Try to be a fool about a limited number of things." I close my mouth. "He always was my favorite of them," Aga goes on merrily. "Kind and steadfast, kept you out of trouble despite your best efforts." I yank the covers off myself. "Dilo and I have a strictly professional relationship. And when we were younger and you wouldn't shut up about him? Aga, guess what me and Dilo did today? Aga, you wouldn't believe what Dilo said to Ixion. Aga, Dilo's definitely the nicest of the lot." "That was years ago. Well, he brought the aloe yesterday." I'd be more irritated if I wasn't so glad to see her old mischievous smile. Aga used to be a terrible tease before Aemon passed. I scowl at her, which delights her even more. "Aga, there's something else." As Aga supplies fresh ginger to her mug, I lower my voice and tell her about Rhodes' original accusation. Aga's brows knit together as she understands. "You think the children heard us talking about Antigone?" Becca is pounding already mashed aloe at the table behind us, half listening. "Everyone wants to be Antigone when we play Dragon Riders," she announces. "I get to be her most often because I'm a girl." Shrines on the karst above. "It's no fair," Garrett agrees from under the table. Aga closes her eyes. "I told you no more dragon riding games," she says. Her face is draining of color. The teasing smile she offered me a moment ago is sliding away. "You told us no more dragon riding games in the house." Which means they've been playing it in the street. Pretending to be Antigone Sir Ayla, the Kallipolan first rider, in the street. Where any passing dragonborn might witness. Aga's face stiffens in horror. Her eyes squeezed shut as she lowers her face into her hands. Becca notices, tensing with fear at the sight of her mother's alarm. I take the seat beside Becca, pull her into my lap, and turn her away from Aga while Aga wipes her eyes. "Becca, Garrett, you can't use Antigone in games anymore. Especially not in the street." "Why?" Garrett asks. It's not safe. Becca's voice gets small.
All right.
She's thin, weightless as a bird, and I squeeze her until she squeals and squirms away, a chirrup of laughter escaping her. Aga watches us blank-faced, unseeing, the look she had most often after Eamon went into that mine and didn't come out. I reach out to take her hand. We'll be fine. A feast day is declared upon Ixion's return. He brings back gifts from the Basileian court, whiskey for the lords, perfume for the ladies, and the promise of even more trade ships on their way from Basilia. Even now, they wind their way through the karst of sailors' folly. Freyda would like to resume our old trading partnership, and she would like to see Ixion again. Feast days are one of the rare times when the whole island comes together, Norseans and Dragonborn. The Hay Aurelian Citadel sacrifices firewood for a bonfire, Norsian drums pound from the top of Conqueror's Mound, and the water-infused whiskey runs free. Becca and Garrett run wild underfoot with the other children from our village. Tonight, Ixion tells us, in a speech from the plinth in the center of Conqueror's Mound, in his strange, flat Norish, is a time of celebration. Tonight we celebrate the beginnings of an alliance. Tonight we toast the long-awaited return. Conqueror's Mound was once the Moot Hill, the meeting ground between the clans, and from it the five clan castes can be seen if you stand in place and turn. Nag, Kraken, Turret, Gnoll, and Thornrose. Now a statue of Tarquin the Conqueror and his Aurelian occupy the summit. And all eyes are on Ixion, standing between the stone dragon's haunches, not the karsts on the horizon. With whiskey flowing and Ixion's voice resounding, Norseans cheer the dream of the long-awaited return as if it were their own. I keep to the back of the throng on an overturned barrel beside Bran and Fiona, drinking watered whiskey and willing myself to think nothing. Aga joins us and introduces a friend from a neighbouring clan. It's the careful way she says this, coupled with her friend's unusual good grooming, that give it away. Aga's friend, Shay, is from Clan Thornrose, favoured by the Hay Aurelians, hated by the rest of us. Bran does not take long to address this point. So how does it feel coming from a clan of traitors? Aga, who has no patience for what she calls petty clan rivalries, heaves a sigh. Eamon was from Kraken. I'm inclined to agree with her most of the time. Bran and Fiona aren't from Nag. They're my closest friends, and it's no secret clan rivalries help the Hay Aurelians deflect from who the real enemy is. But Thornrose is its own case. Shay is more than up to defending herself, though. She holds her own against Bran with a dead stare. You're one to talk. At least Thornrose doesn't ride dragons for them. Would if they could, Bran mutters. I really don't see what you have to resent us for, Shay says, looking around at the three of us, all humble riders. Most Norsian girls would be unnerved at such an audience, but this one seems keen to rise to the challenge. She has the scrubbed look of a Hay Aurelian house servant and wears no wedding band.
You're squires. You'll probably rule Kallipolis with them when all's said and done.
Bran snorts into his whiskey. Fiona gives him a hard look.
We won't be around that long, Bran tells Shay.
Fiona purses her lips at him. I tell Shay, the families of the squires will be rewarded with land. At the sound of the old promise recited so patly, Fiona lets out a strange, shrill giggle. Her hair is down from its usual braid, waist length and full. She's kept up her cups with us, and it's flushed her burn scar crimson. Shay stares at her. Bran places a hand on Fiona's shoulder. It's level with his elbow.
Fiona, not now, he murmurs in dragon tongue.
Was there a joke?
Shay asks, also in dragon tongue, looking between us.
Norish, asks Aga quietly. Please.
My sister,
The only one among us who hasn't been educated in the conqueror's tongue. The only one wearing a widow's scarf. Fiona twines her arm into Aga's with sisterly affection and reverts to our language.
Land to our families, she tells Shay. Note the wording, because they're awfully vague about what will happen to us.
As soon as Shay understands, she looks stricken. Aga and I have never discussed this point, though I see from how her shoulders draw together that it's not a new thought for her either.
The High King wouldn't allow that, Shay says.
Fiona hiccups.
The High King,
she repeats, with a finger and a glare to the far side of the fire, where Leary Thornrose, supposed High King of the Norseans, mingles with his overlords and the guards his clan provides them.
You think that puppet can help us? Norcia is dead, and us with it.
Silence sits for a moment. Bran gets to his feet with sudden violence and turns to Fiona.
Dance with me!
He sounds furious.
They won't allow it.
Fiona's right, I tell Bran.
To hell with what they'll allow!
He takes Fiona's hand and yanks her into the crowd, their mismatched heights setting their dance lopsided. Aga lets out a sudden giggle, watching.
He's so tall, and she's so round, she says fondly, like their karsts.
I laugh aloud at the picture, delighted by it. Turret and Nall, dancing. Norsian clans uniting, the last thing the Haerelians want. I should be scared for them, but all I can feel as I watch them dance is a wild, straining rage that feels a bit like joy. I want Bran and Fiona to keep dancing until the whole bloody island sees. Shay has turned to look at me with a similarly hopeful expression. All at once, I understand why Shay of Clan Thornrose would be introducing herself into a circle of humble riders. One of us could make a good match. She would make a good match. Pretty, well-fed, clearly comfortable in her station. Our lords would permit the union, and Julia's not here to be jealous of it. It's the kind of future I should aim for, the kind of happiness I'm allowed. And yet, when I look at this girl, intrigued at the presence of a humble rider as if at the presence of a lord, I feel nothing. Aga looks between us with a question in her eyes, and then she touches my arm.
Refill my drink?
She presses an empty cup into my hands, and I make my escape. I'm on my way over to the barrels when I hear my name. Shaynan, the man whom Rode put in the pen, is beckoning from a group of men from clans Turret and Nag, standing in the mouth of an alleyway off the mound, already far in their cups.
Griff here,
Shaynan says, throwing a stiff and bandaged arm around my shoulders.
Saw her himself.
I realize what they're talking about and shrug his arm off.
Why is this entire rock determined to talk about the one subject they should shut up about?
Was one go in the pen not enough for you, I say, or were you hoping to get dropped too?
Shaynan's eyes are gleaming with the purity of faith.
First punishment I ever took that meant something. Antigone's coming for us, Griff. Going to break us from the shackles of dragonborn oppression.
She's coming for us with Calipolin dragonfire, Shaynan. Get your head out of your ass.
Even if I keep wondering whether he's right as the evidence lines up before me, unwanted, that rider saying, wait, the way Antigone stiffened at the word peasant, what if Shaynan and the children playing are onto something? What if Antigone's on our side?
Fool's hope, idle dreams, Mabalena.
I turn on my heel to head away from them, round the corner, and walk nearly head first into Dilo. It's the first time I've seen him since we pursued the scouts. He's recovered well from the burns the Calipolin left on him, though his movements are stiff, arms just a little lifted from his sides, as if to keep from agitating their healing.
What were those men shouting about? He asks.
Nothing. They're drunk.
Are you drunk? Dilo asks.
No?
It's not, strictly speaking, true. I've had my share of whiskey by now. Enough that the night has a liquid edge. And Dilo, standing close, is lit by the bonfire as if through rippled glass. For a moment, the vision shifts. I see Julia instead, taking step after step closer, sealing my fate.
Are you drunk? I ask.
Dilo shakes his head. I can see the bonfire reflected in his eyes. And then I look up and realize where we stand. It was this particular alleyway, with these buckled roofs blotting the sky overhead, when Julia placed my hands on her waist for the first time. I hear my words slur.
This is where Julia started it. I know. I don't want to know why he knows that. Or maybe Aga was right. Maybe I do.
On a wave of recklessness, I lift my tankard.
Should go back. Got a girl waiting for me. My sister's friend.
Dilo blinks once. His gaze skips past me, searching the crowd.
I saw her. She's pretty.
You got a girl waiting for you, Dilo?
Griff, says Dilo, like I just asked a really stupid question.
But whatever he isn't saying only makes me more reckless.
There's always Roxana.
Dilo answers without blinking.
Roxana fancies Ixion.
Or at least she fancies his title. I shrug. Ixion's after the Basileian princess. Seems like you have an opening. I'm pretty sure telling a dragon lord his marriage prospects with the great lord's daughter ranks as one of my worst infractions in the history of my infraction-strewn service as a humble rider for New Pythos, but Dilo just looks at me,
and I can feel my heart beating.
I wait for him to take a step closer, like memory Julia did.
He doesn't. So I do.
You waived the punishment. Rode dropped it.
Dilo nods.
I am nose to nose with him, testing it, seeing if he'll order me to back down. I can hear his breath, feel its warmth as it hitches. He remains where he stands, gaze steady.
Why? I ask. You don't deserve it.
I should be grateful, but all I can think of is how Aga's face contorted when she realized her children's danger. Danger for playing a child's game in the street.
Grateful? I'm not grateful. I'm full of rage, and a bit of ginger and aloe isn't enough to make me calm.
Do the rest of us deserve it? Did Shaynan deserve it? Mabelaina?
Dilo's voice is faint. You're different. And there's nothing I can...
I remember standing paralyzed in this same place 3 years ago at Julia's approach. But this time, I'm not the one who's paralyzed. This time, I'm the one who knows what's happening. I'm in control. Or as much as I need to be to make the point, because I can feel Dilo's closeness working on me like its own drug, and it turns out that if Julia was wine, Dilo's whiskey. A proof I can't handle.
The urge to touch him. Those shoulders. That neck. Those curls.
But anger from the depths of my being controls my movements. My face closes the distance to his. Leaning so close, we're both tensed with the effort not to touch. I can hear my own breath quicken. And then a shudder as he swallows, his mouth opening as his lips turn toward mine.
And I've won. I step back.
Bullshit, I tell him. My body burning, hands, fists at my sides.
I walk away.
14. Battle plans. Annie. Chris's and Duck's survey maps of New Pythos, together with the numbers they collected on the Pythian fleet, mean we can move forward with offensive action, and must do so quickly if we hope to attack before the winter frost grounds the fleet. The entire corps is activated with the exception of Chryssa, who remains in the infirmary. When I finally summon up the courage to face her, the night before we depart, I find her sitting up in bed, but unable to leave it. "On the bright side," Chryssa says, "the dragon's bite was so hot it cauterized itself, so there's no need for amputation." Her light tone brooks no sympathy for the agony she must have experienced, or the long ride home on an injured dragon. "So you'll..." Chryssa guesses what I can't bring myself to ask. "Walk again? Eventually." As her superior, it's my job to thank Chryssa for her service and the maps she so carefully drew in exchange for a mauling. But she's also a friend my orders got hurt. Looking at her now, bedridden and bandaged, I can't help wondering if this is only the beginning. It isn't helped when Chryssa says, in that same light tone, "Be careful out there." We fly out for Fort Arran the next morning. The fort is ancient, crumbling from the first Aurelian invasion, and looks out over the blustery cove filled with warships that will guard the coast while the aerial fleet advances into Sailor's Folly. The drafts that whistle in from the North Sea leave the dragons miserable and me shivering. I'm in the guardhouse off the ramparts, prepping gear and trying to tune out Ayla's discomfort as it seeps through the stones, when Kor comes to find me. He has the group lists clutched in his hand.
"Can Doc go in Lee's group?"
I straighten from the piles of spare coolant I'm sorting. I've got Lee in reserve, leading the team of unsparked dragons covering Fort Arran. Defending is the traditional role of the Alternus, but I knew when I assigned Lee his part and watched his face arrest that neither of us was fooled by this reason. It's because I don't trust him to perform. Not after he's refused to drill, and not after that night at the Lyceum Granary when he failed to follow orders. I don't know if Lee knows which side he's fighting for right now, but I'm pretty sure the side he doesn't think he's fighting for is Atreus's. Confirmed by the fact that, when I told him he'd stay at Fort Arran, he didn't argue it. Like he's relieved I'm not going to make him choose either. But I'm not about to explain this reasoning to Kor, who disappeared along with Lee the night of the Passy raid. Now isn't the time to wonder about Lee's and Kor's sympathies with a radical protest group back in the city. Our eyes are facing north. Lee's team is composed of riders who are unsparked. Dark Caserta has sparked. Kor stands in front of me with his arms folded, that list tight in his fist. He's left the door behind him open, and the chill salt breeze flavors the air. The sun never seems to pierce the clouds this far north. We stand shrouded in half light.
"Lee's sparked," Kor says.
"Lee is Alternus. He's supposed to defend. And he hasn't been on a drill since the duel. No one's saying Duck has flame shock, Kor." This is a simplification of the call I made, looking over the list hours ago. My nerves about Duck's performance balanced with my need for a fleet of sparked riders against New Pythos. I judged with an unbiased eye, which meant Duck, whose spotty performance doesn't undo his ranking in the core or his sparked dragon, will deploy like the rest. Kor lets out a noise of indignation at the comparison.
"Annie, come on!"
"I can't assign duties based on whom I love." My voice cracks, but it seems to bring Kor to his senses. He reaches up, his fingers slicing his hair.
"Then can he go with you?"
It's not the request I expect from a boy who hasn't spoken to me since the Lyceum sacking.
Please, Kor adds. I'm distracted when I'm worried about him.
Kor and I have never been close. He was always Lee's friend where Duck was mine. But it seems, in preparing for battle, even the members of the Kor I'm not close to feel like family. This is a boy I've grown up with, gone home with, and even with relations frosted in an unresolved fight, he comes to me because he trusts my skill in the air and my love for his brother as sufficient to protect him. I am strangely, painfully touched. Of course. He'll be my wing rider. Kor nods, then turns on his heel and is gone. We prepare for a launch before dawn, timing our arrival with sunrise, maximizing as far as they are mutually compatible, visibility and surprise. The night before, I review for the last time the attack plan in a drafty council room in which 30 guardians have crammed in concentric rings around a single table. The sketches that Chrissa made of New Pythos have been enlarged to full-scale maps tacked to the wall. We go over targets. Rhadamanthus's Hall, the palace extension that seems to have been built for the Kallipolin exiles, and the Hay Aurelian manors whose slate roofs and walled gardens distinguish them clearly from the thatch of the Norsian villages that cluster on the slopes below. Avoid thatch. Our targets are buildings with slate roofs only. They should be easy enough to tell apart. Darius makes a skeptical noise. But most of it's thatch, he says in his crisp patrician palace standard, which seems to mean that the Norsians' vulnerability as targets makes them either good ones or unavoidable. I point an index finger into the table. I'm asking you to aim, Darius. Alexa, another Storm Scourge rider, snorts into her palm. Last time Darius and I confronted each other, it was in an arena match where I defeated him in front of everyone in this room. From the way his pale face reddens at my remark, he hasn't forgotten. He lifts his eyes to the ceiling, tosses gold hair back from his forehead, and when he realizes I'm still looking at him, he lifts his hands. All right, I'll aim. I proceed with the agenda. We are also to target the inordinate number of Basilean ships that Chrissa and Duck sighted in the main harbour.
Those are trade ships, Duck objects. Civilian vessels.
This is what I pointed out when General Holmes gave me this order, and I repeat Holmes's answer. They're violating the embargo agreed on by the Medean League after the Pythian attack on Starved Rock. This is a proportionate response.
The kind that starts a war, Lee says.
Another objection that Holmes rolled over. The God King hasn't deployed a warship in decades. His son's sickly, and we're not even sure the King's Goliathan is still airworthy. Goliathan reproduction is closely controlled by the Basilean monarchy, one per generation and male heir. We all know this, but it isn't quite enough to satisfy them, as it wasn't enough to satisfy me. Lee's mouth twists as he rubs at a knot in the wood of the dusty table.
The whole point, Rock says, is that we're not the ones who attack civilian vessels.
He's right, but thanks to this medal on my shoulder, it's my job to argue with him. I look around at the blanching faces and make the amendment I did not share with Holmes. Aim for the masts. Their crews should have time to abandon ship if the fires start high. Rock mutters an expletive. Lee's voice is quiet, studying that knot in the wood.
And the muzzled riders?
The War Council's order in this case was clear. Chris's injury at the hands of a muzzled rider was sufficient reason for Holmes to reject my proposed diplomatic strategy. The Norsians are to be treated as enemies alongside their lords. And though her injury should have been enough for me too, it isn't quite. Duck and Chrissa counted 7 muzzled riders out of a fleet of 23. They witnessed them forced to compete in a melee outnumbered against their dragonborn lords. 7 riders, I can't help thinking, could be enough to break a fleet. I look at Duck. Duck was there when Chrissa was attacked. He knows better than I what call to make. And more than that, he's merciful to the core. Duck frowns and scrapes at a curl at the edge of his forehead. It's true, he says, that one of their number attacked us and injured Chrissa. But it's also true that they must be operating with some level of coercion. Those muzzles, you wouldn't believe them if you saw it. A shudder goes through him, and the riders watching him go still at the sight. We can all imagine it. It wouldn't be just our dragons who would feel that iron clamping down, restraining. We would. Kor breaks the silence. His arms are folded. Coerced or not, they're clearly dangerous. Duck nods. Of course, but... Here he lifts his eyes to mine, like he's offering me something and wants me to see it. I'd support the first rider on this. I offer him the smallest nod of thanks. We defend ourselves, but also, where possible, show mercy. On the ramparts of Fort Arran, in the torchlight before dawn, we do a final check of our dragon's armor and each other's flame suits. The wind bites, and my eye is constantly on the horizon for a sign of the first break of winter storms and the snow that will put an end to dragonfire for the season. Duck shivers while I check his armor, standing close to Serta for warmth, her wing mantling him. But I hardly feel the cold. All I can do is count. Riders on the ramparts, coolant shafts full, miles to New Pythos. Odds of return. Medics are here, in the bay below. Cots laid out, kits ready. Holmes informed me of all of this to reassure me. It did the opposite. You all right? Duck murmurs. I know the clarity will come, but before the launch, without Ayla's mind mingling with my own, I'm not there yet. The numbers are too loud. I'm all right. You? Duck nods. He's checking me over now, tugging on straps, testing coolant shafts with gentle pressure. I'm ready, he says. I'll have your back, Annie. Duck knows my rank and his. He must know it's not me who's being protected. But if this is the story he's telling himself to feel courage in the face of danger, he should have it. And I'll have yours. I kiss him on the cheek, and as I turn away, I hear him swallow. Ayla is snorting and tossing her head, agitated by the plates of armor protecting her flanks and chest. I don't try to still her. Her enthusiasm for the fight will be mine soon enough, and I'll need it. Instead, I triple-check us, count the straps of Ayla's armor as I tap them one by one, run my hands over the canteens and spare coolant attached at her flank, at the valves along my flame suit. The plates of dragon scale armor that fold over each other as I swing my arms and kick my knees. The helmet on my head, the boot knives at my ankles, the first rider's bugle slung over my shoulder. Down the line, riders are climbing onto their dragons' backs, small flames lighting the ramparts as they test their fire. I hoist myself into the saddle, strap my boots one by one into the stirrups, and murmur the order to Ayla. She snorts a burst of flame, hot and true, and quickly sparked. We're as ready as we'll ever be. I lift the bugle to my lips and sound the launch.
15. The Plea. Griff. New Pythos is mobilizing. After scouts return news of movement on Fort Aran, cannons go up on our ramparts, guards of half squadrons deploy to circle overhead, and humble riders are stationed in shifts on the south-facing karsts to keep watch. Bran and I end up atop turret. It's his clan karst. He takes one look over the edge at the floating docks below, the faint echoes of the mining that carves into the heart of the limestone, and his face twists. "She'll collapse at the rate they're going," he mutters. "Why don't they mine Thornrose for a change?" Thornrose is the only clan karst exempt from mining. No barges surround her chubby base, no floating docks or mine shafts drill to her centre. Granda says the Haeorelians used to let us mine the Nameless Karst farther out in Sailor's Folly, but it was slower, the ferrying less reliable, the returns poorer. Once the Kallipolans arrived with their dragons, it was easy enough to compel the Norseans to mine each other's clan casts. Turret mines Kraken, and so on. "Nag's hollowed out too," Bran adds, as if I didn't know. I look past Thornrose to my own clan cast, a shadow behind the greater island of New Pythos, the shrine of standing stones, sharp on her crown like ears, and the switchback stairs going down her neck like a mane. The sight of the barges pulled up around her, carving out her insides, is something I try not to think on. I know. Bran hands me the spyglass and leaves me with the dragons while he kicks around in the underbrush at the base of the standing stones, shooing puffins and clearing dead vines from his clan's shrine. The hammering of miners in the shafts below echo distantly on the water, mingling with the sound of carts of ore being emptied into barges that make a slow passage back to the Pythian harbour. "Shannon's got this theory," Bran calls, and I groan, but he raises a hand. "That the scouts came round because Antigone Sir Ayla plans to target only dragonborn strongholds. Spare Norseans." "Why would she care about Norseans? She's not Norsean. She's a peasant, isn't she? Bloody puffins!" He shoos the birds and tosses a bundle of dead vines over the edge. I pass him the spyglass, blinking my vision clear. Shannon's theories are going to get Norseans hurt. It turns out I'm right. When I get off a double shift and make my way back to Clan Nag late in the evening, I find Nita, Ixion's Storm Scourge, lounging outside my family's front door. His folded wings spread across the alley like a deconstructed tent. The street is deserted. None of our neighbors linger outside with a dragon on their stoops. I step over Nita's crossed front talons, ignoring his hackling crest and bared fangs, and push the door open. Inside, Granda sits across the table from Ixion. Ixion wears a flame suit and armor. Like me, he has been doing back-to-back patrols. Aga is pouring whiskey into two glasses from a bottle finer than any we own, with shaking hands. "Griff, welcome," Ixion says. "I hope you don't mind my visiting your family during this busy time." I scout the rest of the room quickly. Becca and Garrett are crouched in the corner, quiet, but judging by the way they're fidgeting, they won't be for much longer.
"Lord Ixion was kind enough to come bearing gifts," Granda tells me.
"Becca, Garrett, go out back."
"I'd like them to stay," says Ixion. He
nods at the label of the bottle held in Aga's hands.
From Basilia, the real kind. Another cup for Griff.
Aga goes to the cupboard, retrieves a third cup and fills it. She presses it into my hand, and though she doesn't risk looking up at me, I squeeze her fingers tightly as I take the bottle from her. She goes to stand beside the little ones, a little bit in front of them, as if not quite daring to make clear that she stands between them and Ixion. Ixion lifts his glass. I lift mine. And Ixion toasts in softly accented Norish.
To loyalty.
I tilt my glass back and feel the liquor burn its way down my throat. Ixion sets down his glass.
Your grandfather and I, he says, were just discussing an interesting bit of gossip that I seem to have missed while I was away in Basilia. The fact that this entire rock can't stop talking about the Kallipolin's peasant first rider. I was asking Grandfather how he thinks this happened, since no one on this rock saw the peasant first rider. Now, I know Griff claims he was the one sharing the story round, but we both know you're not that stupid, are you, Griff? Which leaves me to wonder who else might be to blame. Makes me wonder if it were not a case of childish indiscretion, or perhaps irresponsibility on the part of the mother? I hear the first rattle from Aga beside me, her lungs beginning to refuse air. Before I can say a word, she falls to her knees and places her palms on the floor. And then she begins to speak, and my stomach coils as I realize what she is saying. Aga, in front of her own children, is reciting a plea.
Forgive me, my lord, for my indiscretions, which were not intended in faithlessness. Grant that my punishment duly owed not be given to my family blameless.
The pleas are what you offer to the Dragonborn when you have offended past explanation. When choosing your own words becomes a presumption, and you offer one of the formalities you were taught as a child to be ready with instead. The last time I heard someone recite a plea, it was Mabelaina in the public square. They let her do it, and then they dropped her family anyway. Becca and Garrett have been learning the pleas from Aga for the last year now. But Aga's coughing ruptures the plea mid-sentence, and as she coughs, Ixion smiles. He flicks his hand down to gesture to her, his eyes only on me.
This, he says, is the kind of respect I like, Griff.
Garrett has started to cry. Becca, who seems to understand that even that is not permitted in this moment, pulls him to her and shushes him. Granda has risen, and then frozen, in a half-crouch from his chair, the lines of his face twisted. Lazily, Ixion's gaze travels down to Aga's bent and shuddering head.
Your plea is accepted by your lord.
Aga lets out a sob of relief, her elbows folding under her weight.
You may already know, Ixion goes on,
that the Citadel is mobilizing for an expected attack from Kallipolis. In reward for your piety, I would like to take your children into shelter somewhere safe until the threat has passed. Aga braces on her wrists to twist up and look at me, searching my reaction with tear-bright eyes. My reaction is that anything offered by Ixion is a threat. Thank you, my lord, but we would keep them here, I tell Ixion.
I wasn't asking.
Ixion lifts a hand to Becca and Garrett, summoning them as he would a dragon or a dog.
Come.
Neither moves. Aga inhales, her shoulders setting, and then eases back onto her heels so she can turn to look at them.
Go with your lord. You'll be safe with him.
Becca has started crying too.
You'll come with us?
Aga looks up at Ixion, who shakes his head,
Aga's face ripples and then stills again. I'll be waiting for you when you come back, she tells them. She kisses them each on the forehead, as lightly as if she were sending them to market, and neither of them notices the discreet motion she makes with thumb and forefinger on their brows, tracing the sign of the nag. Only after they have each taken a hand of Ixion's and the door has closed behind them, does Aga lower her face to the earth and begin to sob. For a half moment, I am rooted where I stand, and in that moment, Granda rises, goes to Aga, and pulls her stiffly into his wiry arms.
The nag will keep them, darling, he says. Do not weep so soon.
But she can't stop. A wild thought, so wild I don't dare look closely at it, has seized me. I grip the handle of our door.
Griff, where are you going, son?
I'm going to find someone who can help. I leave Aga in our grandfather's arms and take off, at a run, for the Citadel. Out of Clan Nag, across Conqueror's Mound and through the humble gate, up the winding stairs and down the skyfish wing of the Provisional Palace, and then... Dilo emerges from a council room, like Ixion in a flame suit, ready for the alarm.
Dilo, Ixion took my sister's kids.
I'm panting from the run uphill. Only now that I'm facing him does it occur to me how mad it is to seek Dilo's help in such a matter. That I've just assumed one dragonborn will take my side against another, when he's got all the reason to be as bothered by rumours about Antigone as Ixion, and no reason to care the slightest about Aga's kids. But Dilo only looks alarmed.
Becca and Garrett? Why?
The sound of their names on his tongue makes my knees go weak. I lower my hands to them, gasping.
Said he was taking them somewhere safe.
Dilo's brows draw together. Maybe into the Haoralian's crypt with the Citadel's women and children. That's where they're evacuating. But that doesn't sound right. Why would two Norsian children be sheltered in the Haoralian crypt? Especially not ones whose mother had just confessed to a transgression. Dilo, too, seems unsatisfied with this possibility from how he's frowning. As if he, too, understands that safe from Ixion means danger. But before either of us can discuss it further, the alarm bells begin to toll. And then there's nothing more to say. Not to Dilo, anyway. I take off for the Storm Scourge armory at a run. Ixion isn't there. Already in my flame suit, I seize my pike and shield, scramble past the other riders, and take the spiral stairs two at a time. Ixion is already in the lairs, saddling Nita himself.
Took you long enough.
Where are they?
Ixion tightens the straps to Nita's flank guard with his forearm.
Who?
I slam against him so hard his body hits the wall. As I hold him there, pinned, Ixion leans back against the wall to look at me. The chain of Sparker's key glints on his neck, within my reach. Nita begins to growl. I can hear the murmuring of the Storm Scourge bastards and the Haoralian riders farther down, all within a shout's distance should Ixion alert them. The nearest Norsian rider is Nolan, five nests away, and he and I would be outnumbered 2-1. On the other side of the stone wall, Sparker's growl answers Neeter's, but Sparker is chained.
What now, Garrison?
Ixion murmurs. He looks almost bored. Because he can work out, as well as I can, the ways this moment could unfold, every ill-fated grasp for control I could make. And even in the versions that go the farthest, that result in the greatest triumph, Aga and Becca and Garrett still pay the price. Because I'm outnumbered here, and would be in the air, and defiance would meet only one end.
We are face to face, so close that if I rammed my skull against his, I could break it.
Ixion, unafraid, leans closer. You want those brats back? Get in the air and do what we've trained you to do.
16. The Battle of New Paphos. Annie. We skim within the coverage of the stratus clouds as the sun rises, hugging our dragons' backs for their warmth. But even a dragon's heat isn't enough in the biting cold to prevent ice forming on my visor. The cast forest of Sailor's Folly rises out of a sky turning a deep, rich blue. I can feel Ayla's excitement coursing through me like a second pulse. As we begin to weave through its pillars, silhouettes of wings, small in the distance like bats, peel from the cast and off into the fog. Scouts. Heading back to New Paphos to alert them of our approach. Our skyfish set out after them and return empty-handed. I wave us on. We outnumber them 3-2, and none of our fleet is muzzled. Surprise or no, we'll face them. At last, out of the blue mist it rises. New Paphos. The island fortress sits high and crooked on the waves like a storybook castle. The jagged pillars of cast black against the waves, tendrils of fog wisping and winding through the outcroppings of Sailor's Folly. At the base of the island lie the open arms of a natural harbour, and in it bob the shells of their fishing boats and mining barges, and the Basilean trade ships we've been ordered to burn. From out of the citadel, from off the nearest cast, rises the aerial fleet like a flock of weighty birds. The rising sun flickers on tendrils of high cloud, the Aurelians glinting gold, and the skyfish silvery blue, and the storm scourges splotches of dark against the lightning sky, spreading out in formation to meet us. Kor's group peels off toward the harbour, and I call after him. Remember! Masts first! Got it, Annie, Kor shouts. Power and I make for the island itself. My group splits to offer coverage for the storm scourge low passes, and as wing riders pair off, Duck comes to my side. At your wing! The citadel rises to meet us. Concentric rings of stone, the palace annex jutting from the highest keep across from the great hall. Our first targets. And between them, the Pythian aerial fleet arrayed across the cloud banks like a wall. Nothing we haven't drilled, although in drills our dragon's fire was doused. Barrel through, I tell Power, and we'll engage. In the lingering darkness, it's impossible to tell muzzled dragons from free. We accelerate as we approach, the gravity of our descent to our advantage, and the first bursts of dragon fire light the still dark sky.
Griff. Ixion waits until they are minutes, meters from our wall of defense before raising his voice. The Triarchal Riders are in reserve at the center, followed by the Bastards, with the Humble Riders on the front line, and Sparker, Pride of the Fleet, leads it. His great wingspan spreads on either side of me like a bulwark, looming all the larger in Nitr's cast-off armor. Wing to wing, encircling the citadel in a loose cyclone, all the Humble Riders are within range of Ixion's cry. Squires! Your attention, please. A ripple through the riders holding the line, helmeted heads of the Humble Riders turning. The line of Kallipolans approaching, filling our horizon. So many of them. And all of those Kallipolans turned on the lords we hate with the sole mission of destroying them. Out of gratitude for your service, Ixion says, your lords have taken it upon themselves to ensure the safety of your families. They have been offered refuge within the Great Lord's Hall, the Provisional Palace, and the Haorelian Manors. They will remain there until the fighting is finished. On the Triarchal Row, meters behind mine, Dilo lifts his visor to look at Ixion, and then his gaze travels past him to me. Garrett and Becca aren't in the crypt,
They're above ground, in the most significant dragonborn strongholds on the island. They're inside the targets. Sparker lets out a growl low in his throat. We thank you, Ixion goes on, for your full fervor in defending our great island and its lords. Before any of us can answer, can even respond, the line of Kallipolans is on us. And then the world begins to burn.
Annie. I feel Ayla's mind snap into connection with mine, the spillover initiated like a knot pulled tight. I'm riding low, pressed close to her as we increase speed, covering the Storm Scourge charge with Duck on my wing. Power Sir Eater breaks through first, and as they hurtle down toward the Citadel, we flip and roll into the sights of the Skyfish they've swerved past. All around me, Skyfish and Aurelians are slamming into the Pythian line, engaging as our Storm Scourges break through it. We'll hold them while the Storm Scourges turn their wretched Citadel into a blaze site. Ayla and I break from the rider we're grappling with, momentum flinging us in opposite directions, and as we spin, I strain for sight of Duck. He and Serta are locked in combat with a muzzled Aurelian rider. She's forced a contact charge, and the two pairs are twisting and turning in mid-air like cats rolling in a fight as she strains to find an opening for her pike. She fights with the desperation of a cornered animal. Duck can hardly gain the advantage. He fires. The rider screams but doesn't let go. We charge, slamming into her from the far side, and when Duck fires once more, at last she disengages. Duck Serta is spinning, on the verge of freefall.
You all right?
I'm fine.
Even muffled through his helmet, I can hear his frustration.
She sure made it hard to go easy on her.
Looking at the scrabbling pairs of dragons around us, I wonder how many more of my riders are making the same realization about the muzzled Pythians. Showing mercy may not be in the cards if they're attacking like that.
Stay at my wing!
Below us, fires have begun to sprout from the Citadel. Its roofs, its stables, as our Storm Scourges begin to make their marks. And out over the harbor, the masts of the Basilean trade ships begin to burn like so many lit matches. And then I look again at the blaze site below and notice something else. A Skyfish rider, a Pythian, has landed in front of the great hall of the Citadel. The roof is already smoking, its corner ablaze and spreading. The dragon has the doors of the hall in its jaws and is yanking. Like it's trying to open them, like they're bolted shut. And that Skyfish, I recognize him. Dilo Skyfish. The Alternus who was so cordial to me at the drop-off. What is he doing on the ground during battle yanking on doors? And then a charge comes out of nowhere into Ayla's side, and I lose sight of the Skyfish as we spin. We take in the black of a Storm Scourge belly, a wingspan the length of a warship, and I feel the flare of something like anticipation. Garrison. Finally. Griff's Storm Scourge charges with the momentum of a falling boulder. Ayla and I swerve left, barely rolling under his wing to gain the advantage, but they roll with us. And I feel a thrill that has nothing to do with the battle, and only to do with the fact that I haven't had an opponent to challenge me like this since Lee. And then I hear something that cuts short all my joy of the fight. Garrison is sobbing. It's muffled in his helmet, barely discernible above the wind and the roars of the dragons around us. I hear myself say his name.
Griff. There are too many places they could be, too many fires below, too many Kallipolan riders to hold off.
but Ixion and I do our best. All my life we've flown together, vied against each other, loathed each other. But it seems today that loathing has exploded into something else. Something that moves across the skies over New Pythos like a storm as we take one after another of these Kallipolan bastards down.
You should be grateful, Ixion shouts. Better they're safe in a proper fortification than in your bit of kindling.
But if those fortifications catch fire, they'll get out. They'll get to safety. The words don't matter. All that matters is the hatred coursing between me and Sparker, molten. And I know that Ixion knows it, as I know it. This fury makes us powerful. It's in his interest to stoke it as it's in mine to feel it. And in the few spare moments that we glimpse the earth, I see that he is wrong. Antigone's doing just as Shaynan and Bran hoped she would, and I scoffed at imagining. Sparing the Norsian housing, targeting the Haerelians and the exiles. And somewhere below, in a home that isn't theirs, the little ones are huddling without even their mother to comfort them. When we find her, Ixion and I veer like beings of one mind, me to occupy, him to descend from above. And in that instant, I want to tear Antigone Sir Aela apart. For her mercy. For her discretion. For being everything the fools of my village hoped she would be, and it mattering not at all. Ixion is rising up behind her, about to close the charge. We'll have her pinned. And then she says my name.
Annie. Griff? For a moment, we both freeze. Our dragons are meters apart, preparing for another contact charge. I can make out his great Storm Scourge's fiery eyes beneath that iron muzzle. The sound of Garrison's sobbing stops. And then he growls, so low I hardly hear it.
Above you.
We veer. A split second before a blast from above buffets us on its current. The heat of it explodes across Ayla's left wing as we roll. A second Storm Scourge bears down on us, and this one is almost as great as Garrison's in girth. Its crest tipped silver, and its armor bearing the sigil of Storm Scourge House.